Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's happiest podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorales. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, I have a pharmaceutical physician for a biotech firm, Dr. Harsha Shetty. How are you doing, Harsha?
Hi, George. I'm good, thank you. How have you been today?
I'm good as well. It's a very polite way of starting the podcast.
Oh, and just to mention, you're here in a personal capacity, not a professional one. Just want to put that out there. So,
you're enjoying yourself. What are you up to at the moment?
Enjoying the COVID sort of a lockdown, to be honest. It's given me a sense of space where I can reflect on a couple of things. And one of the things that I'm reflecting on is trying to read,
okay.
Relate to...
Oh, you're just trying to vibe with me right now, aren't you?
I know.
So, you're pandering. We can tell already.
And then I'm so glad to be here, as in to meet you face-to-face.
Yeah.
After a really long period of lockdown, I'm enjoying that people side of things as well. Mm-hmm. So that's been great. Work's busy.
Because whether you're working with COVID directly or not, there's a real focus on that element with you guys.
Like, as in most times, I think pharma can get a bad rap, and for good reason, because some of the stuff, let's say some areas of the industry.
On most occasions, yes.
It's probably nice to be there when you're like, hey, look, we are good though. We do good things.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very insightful thing in this pandemic. And you would have seen all the companies collaborating with each other, and they're technically competitors, but they are trying to collaborate with each other to bring breakthrough therapies and bring medicines, treating patients and vaccines, preventing illness. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and which is like how it should be, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the way it should be. I think it's a new way of, working, I would think, yeah.
Yeah. So what exactly is your role within the company now as a pharmaceutical physician?
So I'm a sort of a pharmaceutical physician, worked across different areas within the industry, I would think, medical affairs, clinical safety, and clinical development. And now I'm the clinical safety, which essentially is a department which looks after the safety aspect of the drugs. And if you've seen in the media now, I think it's a lot of focus on safety of vaccines. A lot has been told in the media, and everybody's talking about safety and terms like pharmacovigilance and vaccines. So that's sort of where I work. Extremely right. Complex area and extremely cautious and well-regulated space.
Yeah. as you know, right? So when you're saying that, you're not talking about like, are you talking about the safety of the delivery of it, or are you talking about the actual safety, like side effects and things like that, or is that covered within the other area?
It's both. It's up until it's both the side effects and as well as the delivery in terms of actual administration of the drug.
Yeah,
it's both the healthcare setting in which the drug is delivered as well as the product profile side effects as well. So it's both.
Right. So you're very relevant right now. So like basically to think of the people who, like, obviously there's been a lot of, let's say, vaccination questioners in the last few years, and the kind of thing they do is like, oh, it's untested, side effects are going to be bad, people haven't done everything. You're kind of involved in the area which is like, no, we've tested the hell out of this, is it safe, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. I think it's a very hard thing to understand for the normal public because they have not been exposed to the drug development process in general, and they are always at the receiving end of things in terms of utilization of the drugs for and medicines. But it's a hard concept to assimilate even for the physicians in terms of what the testing involves and what level of rigor goes through in validating these results by the healthcare regulators in each of these countries. So at the end of the day, pandemic is different scenario. You're not playing by the normal rule books and you need to fit it to the purpose and the demand that's there at this point in time. If you look at how the drug development works, it takes about 10 to 15 years to develop one drug at different phases. And what we are trying to do here is to bring the milestones forward and working across different phases in parallel rather than sequential.
Right.
And that's what I mean by bringing the milestones forward. And that's where the companies come in, because these companies are operating in a way that it's at risk for them by having multiple phases. And as the data is evolving, the next phase of the drug development is already being started. And the manufacturing is started at risk. You don't know if the drug works or not, but they're manufacturing at risk because it's what is happening at this stage in pandemic.
Right. So you're saying, like, as in, it's more you're throwing out, you're developing it far, you're going through the milestones faster. With the real risk here is monetary, essentially, because, like, you could lose, well, not monetary, but kind of monetary, as in, like, all this could be a waste because we're doing it, like, at the same time. And it could actually be, like, in a normal case, you would take 5 years because you would realize a lot earlier where you screwed up and then you wouldn't keep going. In this case, because you're doing it all at the same time, you're risking losing money or whatever, just like on these trials going ahead where they wouldn't have in a different time.
Different time. And, and also, time. It's the clinical need.
Yeah.
And what's the clinical need is at this point in time, what's the unmet need is. And I think what's happened in pandemic is also that the different stakeholders are being involved quite early, like healthcare regulators and different bodies that evaluate the data are kept closer to the data. And it's been probably done on an ongoing basis so that everything is fast-tracked and the drug reaches the patient or the vaccine reaches a person in a very fast manner, fast-paced manner. So that's right. Probably what the goal is.
Yeah, yeah.
To come out of this pandemic as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So to go hand in hand, what you're saying is it's not rushed. The standards aren't lower. It's just, I mean, it's not rushed as in terms of badly rushed. It's rushed. Yes, we're doing everything faster, but it doesn't mean the standards are any lower.
It's a risk-based approach. That's what the framework would be. It's a risk-based approach in terms of what the risk is, what level of risk is acceptable, how much benefit is balanced against the risk.
Yeah.
It should always be that the benefits outweigh the risk.
Exactly. Yeah. And I guess that's where I'm trying to wrap my head around it. And maybe you can help like explain it, because I'm genuinely intrigued. I kind of think I know how it's all done.
It's a little bit hard to understand in terms of what the amount of work that goes behind the scene. Because it's a complex process, and the B, it's not out there open for everybody to understand this unless you are in the industry or at least closely reviewing the process and the policies around it.
But like, if someone wanted to know, they could go look it up.
Absolutely.
Well, right? Yeah. It's not like it's hidden in that sense. Yeah. It's
absolutely.
Bureaucratic stuff, which is just a bit annoying. But yeah, you could go look it up if you wanted to.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And it's also looking at the right resources in terms of the right set of right websites or right places
that
to look.
Be clarified as well.
I mean,
don't go on Reddit.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we will go to the book stuff, but I just want to hear a bit more about this. In terms of the trials, right? I don't know if you want to pick one, but of these trials, is it you just inject a bunch of people with it after you've done obviously the prep and you've made sure, I'm talking now we're at the human trial point, which obviously people might already be like, oh, that's when the testing starts, but actually you've been testing the whole time, how it all breaks down, how everything works. So you would already, you're not going to human testing without a good assumption that it probably works.
No, absolutely. I think everything has been is, when I say regulated, the concepts that you just described, how we move into human trials from animal data or primate data into human trials, are all guidelines driven and data driven and science driven. If there is no scientific rationale to prove that it is safe and efficacious, there wouldn't be any progression to any phases of human trials. So that's the nature of it. And it's all based on the evidence. So to answer your question, yes, there is a solid body of evidence that drives a molecule from animal to human phase, which is very rigorously evaluated and approved to progress into the clinical trials by the regulators.
Yeah. And then at that point, I guess when you do the trial phase, I'm guessing you try to get the broadest demographic possible just to test it on everyone of different cultural backgrounds, different ages, different medical conditions. So from the start, or do you kind of start off with a healthy cohort and then expand?
You start with the healthy cohort, okay. And that's how it works in the phase one trials. You try and, unless there's a disease aspect where you're evaluating and it's unethical to test on a healthy volunteer, you always try and do the healthy volunteer study and move and establish the safety and then move to the disease patients. But
so what's the definition of healthy, I guess, is my first question.
Healthy is basically, as in a very layman term, the body is working fine so that the right, all the attributes of the drug are validated in humans.
But when you say healthy though as well, that is older people and younger, or is it focused on younger people?
Most trials are conducted in between 18 to 60 or 18 to 55.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so,
That's where most trials are being conducted, at least in the initial stages, before they branch out into elderly and pediatric as special subpopulation studies. But yes, in the clinical trial environment, it's quite controlled in the way you choose people.
So with let's go with the corona thing. Just because, like, I really want to be able to basically, I even had the thought for a moment. That's why I'm aware of this mode of thinking, where you're like, oh, maybe I'll wait and see how the US goes or how Europe goes before I take the vaccine, because that way you've got the biggest population size possible to assess its effects. And that was my first thought. But then I was like, wait, but that's still dumb, because these guys have done the trials on these people from a year ago now, how long they've been going, and they've already done the broad spectrum of everyone, I assume. So could you like give me a bit more detail? Am I correct in thinking that? Like, as in, you're not going to get anything for waiting an extra month.
But also, not add any- how long is the wait? What's their concept of wait? I don't know. Is it their family? Is it their friends? Or is it a certain number that hits in Australia? I don't know what
I
that
love
is.
How, like, statistical, I really don't, you're being right now.
I really don't know, because
people are talking. I guess that's my point. So, and that's kind of why I want to understand the process better. Because if I was, I'm going to think of my pops in my head straight is my mum, Greek mum, lovely. But she's just like, oh, maybe I'll wait, just like see how everyone does a month or two, and then maybe I'll take it just to make sure there's no side effects in the community. So that would be what they say. They're like, oh, I would just want to wait a bit longer just to make sure it doesn't impact anyone. But again, I think that's because they're coming from the position of not seeing the trial side of things and just how. Because right now we're like, it's now been probably a year since the first people had phase one trials.
There are millions of doses being administered across the world as we speak. And I think because of the speed in which the vaccination has gone and the amount of vaccinations that have been administered, it's a known case that the new side effects will crop or you'll become aware, because that's the life cycle of any drug. As in when it's been exposed to new set of patients, new set of side effects evolve. It's the same as how you take a paracetamol for fever. It's been around in the market for like so long, but that's the journey that product has had, you know? I mean, at some point that was a new drug and the side effects kept evolving, and then people started discovering new side effects as well. So that's the nature of how it works. But at no point would anybody decide that you should take a, knowing that you are at risk, at more risk than a benefit. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that call will always be made by your doctor or a physician who is administering the medicine to you. And then that's my point, as in you can wait, but then you're also not looking at the benefit just because you're not infected. is COVID better than a side effect? I don't know. It's an individual call.
Oh, man, I think everyone just set off being able to get on a plane. Travel overseas. I'll take any side effect.
So, yeah. I think it's a call. But I think in Australia, I think there's a lot of focus on that's what I see in general media and also on certain groups that I follow, that there's a lot of focus on communication. And there's a lot of communication with regard to vaccination and very transparent discussions on communicating the safety side of things, both for laymen and for physicians, or general public and physicians.
We've gone on vaccine, which is, you probably get drained on this all day, don't you? Whenever you say your job, everyone's like, tell me everything.
I know.
Which one's better?
No, that's true, because you're actually reviewing that, as in carefully looking at the data in a different lens, because you're closer to the process. But people do tend to ask these questions.
Cool. Well, okay, let's get, I haven't even gone into you at all. I've just gone completely straight to this topic, which is, it's very relevant, because I feel like the rollout, is it happening right now? Or is it happening
I think
week?
it's already happening.
It's already happening now. Yep. So anyways, okay. Actually, you know what? Let's do the book and then I'll unpack yours, because I want to hear more about your history. But your book of choice for today is?
Yes, my book of choice today is this book called Mindset, The Psychology of New Success, written by this Stanford psychologist by name Dr. Carol Dweck.
Yep.
So this is the reason why I chose this book is because there are very few books where you kind of go back and refer, and this is one such book where you kind of go back and refer as well. So that's one reason. And the second reason is because I think the way the format of the show works, I think it's book is a starting point to sort of tell your story. So this is kind of what I relate to in terms of the book, building the mindset and then being open to new things and new experiences like what we're having today. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. So that's why the choice of the book.
Ah, you rigged it. I can do it with any book. You don't need to make it for you. We'll figure it out no matter what. But let's to understand that though, the book itself, Mindset, mm-hmm. you're saying you've gone back and referred to it. So firstly, I guess, what exactly, a quick summary of the book in 2 seconds is like.
Carol Dweck's thesis is that there are two types of mindset, growth mindset and fixed mindset. And she basically argues that the intelligence and talent, although it's related to genes that we carry, are not carved in stone. It's not a fixed number, and it's a developing aspect by influences from different environments, environmental exposures, and also different experiences that we encounter. And basically, she argues that if you have a fixed mindset, you tend to have a sense of urgency to prove and prove all over again and validate yourself. But when you have a growth mindset, you're looking at new experiences, new learning, new growth. And that's that doesn't sort of bottle you into any sort of space, and it helps you grow. So it's across different aspects of life, and she talks about different things and different environments, like business, like parenting, friendships, love. And the book is also solution-oriented. It tells you sort of how to have this mindset. I don't think I've gone that far, but then she argues that just being aware of the mindsets make you evolve in the right way. So,
right.
Yeah.
So I guess, so it's actually quite a simple like idea to start off with, because it's just these two mindsets. She's saying that's what kind of exists, the growth one and the fixed one.
Yeah, that's what she says. Yeah.
And fundamentally, it's actually not about, it's about basically one, do you have a mindset which is static, or do you have a mindset which is looking for new things and open to new experience? Is that kind of?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And yep. Does she have like a theory about like, so I say this a lot, like, I think genetics is such a big factor in that. You know what I mean? Like, let's not be too simple minded. Genetics and early stage development from childhood. I feel like those two factors are just so far outweighing anything else in terms of where you end up with that stuff, I guess. That's my knee jerk thought.
I completely agree. Genes and early development is definitely takes you a long way. But if I have to put it in Carol Dweck's words, she says something like, the cards that you're dealt with is just a starting point. And it's not the end point. It's not the born smarts finish smart, but it's also how much they put the effort in the, in developing new things. So that's sort of what she argues. Some are definitely gifted. Genes play a huge role. But she argues that it's not just the genes. It's about exposures, environment, and the effort that goes in. I think that's what we miss when we see all the successful people. We think they're gifted. It's not effortless success. It's always effort-based. And I'm sure people are putting more hard work, even though they know that they're gifted. And that's what differentiates people.
Yeah.
And that's what that's what her argument is.
Right. See, and I guess like to go into, to put it in that perspective, what you're saying there. See, I almost think that the ability to work hard is still a gene. So you might not be a genius. You just work hard and you put the hours in. But even that is something which is in you, which some people have more so than others. So like some people find working hard easy. And it's hard work what they're doing, but the act of working hard itself is easier for some people than others. And that's where like I do find
true.
A bit of...
It's relative. It's definitely relative. And I think it's something which can be cultivated.
Hmm.
So it's not that you, it's all or none. Either you have it or you don't have it, but it can be cultivated. Yeah. And more we cultivate, more we move the needle to where we want to. So that's sort of how... she simplifies it,
yeah,
in one way.
No, definitely. Yeah. I had a friend of both of ours, Rahul Khanna, on a while ago, and since then I've actually gone away and read a bit more philosophy as well. And I mean, the first guy who was doing this was Aristotle, 2,500 years ago. It was basically him saying, we don't have these good habits, but we can cultivate them over time to become part of ourselves. Like, yeah. They were saying this 2,400 years ago. He's literally like, yeah. The human beings aren't born bad or good. They're born with the ability to be great.
Yeah.
But then what you got to do your whole life is essentially try to build the habits which make being good an unthinking process. But at the start, you got to think about it.
Correct.
Do you...
And from the school days, it's interesting that you say that from the Aristotle and the philosophies that people are not born either or. So one of the things that the quotes that stood with me for a long time is from my school where I went to this boarding school in India, and it's under the education system and the philosophy driven by Swami Vivekananda. And he was a monk from India who felt that there needs to be a change in the education system, and he had certain philosophies. And what he essentially says is, education is the manifestation of perfection already in man. And you're born with these perfections, and education is just a process of unraveling it and removing obstacles to come forward. And it's a good philosophy to hang on to. At least it's worked for me. And that's what has sort of driven me to with this book as well. So there are a lot of parallels that you can draw with concepts such as that and the mindset that Carol describes, or Dr. Dweck describes in this book.
Oh, right. Actually, so what was that guy's name?
Swami Vivekananda.
Swami Vivekananda. Does he have a book or something?
He has many books, I think. I think the best one to refer to is it's Complete Works of Swami Vivekananda. It's a very popular book. He's very popular even in the US. He's known for his great oratory skills. He was one of those monks who traveled and then preached about the education system and the philosophies that he believed in. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So let's take a step back now that you've described that, actually, because I do want to hear a bit more about you. You're born in India?
I was born in India.
Right. And you grew up there. It was a big family, small family?
It was a nuclear family. Me and my sister, parents, mom and dad, and my grandma, we lived all together.
Where in India?
We lived in different parts. My dad and mom worked for a bank, which required us to move different cities every 3 or 4 years. So we lived in different cities.
All right.
After a certain point, when I was probably 14, is when I went to the boarding school that I was referring to. And I sort of completed my education there, then did my medicine. And
All at the same school?
No, I did my high school there in the school, which was more of a philosophy-based education system. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I chose to join medicine, did my medical training,
Right, and then you moved to Australia.
So, moved to Australia in 2014. Up until then, I was in India practicing as a pharmaceutical physician, working for different companies at different points. The same thing what I do here, I was doing it there. And we decided to, me and my wife, we decided that we need to explore more, move countries and have more varied experiences. So, we chose Australia.
Arisa, that's why you did it, just for the...
Yeah, it was not out of any other motivation other than exploring and living in different country, absorbing different cultures and exploring. So it's become a home now, I have a 4-year-old son, and that's what has anchored us here. But initially, I think the goal was to sort of move and explore.
Right. So that, I guess, because you're probably relatively comfortable living in India. Like you had a good job. So there's no concern there of moving for
absolutely
better
no
opportunities
no
or anything.
Yes, yes.
It was purely a case of, I guess I'm just showing, I hope I'm not sounding like some colonialist. Right? But most people, when they hear of the immigrant story, a lot of the time it's like, looking for better opportunity and stuff. But you were just like anyone here who goes overseas. It's like you just want a variety and see something new.
Yeah, exactly. So very comfortable. I was very fortunate to be in a family where they provided us good education, a good financial support from both me and my sister, who is also a doctor. So there was a good education system and we were pretty comfortable. Mm. Good jobs. My wife also had a good job, so it was all fine.
She's a doctor as well?
She's a doctor. Ah. She's a colleague of Rahul, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
we did good there. We lived in a very metropolitan city, a very global city that
Which
way.
Which one was it?
It's Bangalore.
Oh, Bangalore, okay.
So it's got a good mix of both, everything, basically. Everything was fine. So we felt there is the need to explore more, move countries, and just have those experience of living in another country, what it means to uproot ourselves from there and be somewhere else.
Yeah.
Just grow with experiences. So that's what made us move.
Oh, no, 100%. I think it's a good part of, if you can do it, it's great.
And it's also the timing. We wanted to do it at that point because you don't know when, what, how settled you will get in the course of your life. And we felt that was the time to do it.
Yes,
opportunity was a factor. It has to be a good opportunity and a balance of things. Definitely, we wanted to progress our career in the way we were progressing there. But the trajectory would... I mean, my colleagues and friends, probably they're doing the same as what I'm doing here. My goal was to sort of explore and be in another part of the country.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's always going to be both. You're doing the statistical likelihood. What's the fail rate? What's the degree of uncertainty? You're doing the works. I get it.
Yeah.
So,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So have you, so you've always had that attitude. I guess this actually ties in with the growth thing, which is very sneaky of you to pick a book which ties in so well.
No, that's my story of life. So seriously, that's the, I wouldn't say, it's sort of what I, what you pursue innately to just grow. And I think the school kind of influenced me to sort of pick that path. I'm probably very atypical that way. Back when growing up, I think a lot of wise people around me said not to choose the field I am in now. Typically, you get trained in medicine, you choose clinical practice and see patients, and that's where you grow. But I was a little sort of different that way. I chose the business world and developing medicines and then impacting health on a large scale basis rather than an individual patient basis. So
really, I'm the real hero here.
So it's different. It's a different trajectory. Yeah. It's based on what motivates you. Here I am. Yeah.
Right. And is that because also, just to like understand that as well, like obviously, maybe you did just look at it purely from a statistical value point of view and you're like, I'm impacting a greater group of people. But also, is it a case where that stuff kind of appealed to you more just in terms of like measuring data and doing calculations and trying to find good measurements? You just preferred that more to the human, the necessary GP activities and stuff? Or
to be honest, I had no clue this world existed when I was doing medicine. Fortunately, I had good mentors who kind of exposed me to these side of medicine. And I think it's actually the key figure who kind of exposed me to this clinical research and pharmaceutical medicine is my dad, actually. So he, when I was preparing for my entrance to choose a specialty, he said, I know you are studying very hard, but try and look at this. You can do this in parallel and it might help you. So I took up a diploma course which taught me everything about drug development, and it kind of fascinated me how much depth and the work that goes in and the impact that you make. And I was exposed to all these people who became my mentors, who kind of showed how fulfilling it is to be part of developing medicines which can impact thousands of people at a large scale.
More than thousands,
more than millions of people. Thousands if you work in a rare disease, but then millions of people, trillions of people who are suffering with this disease. So they showed me that how fulfilling that path is. And I took up a job just to test it for 1 year and to see whether that's my cup of tea or not.
Trial job, yeah.
And then I said, yes, this is where I want to be. And then I quit my job, did my advanced training, which is relevant to pharmaceutical medicine, and came back into the industry. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess that's interesting you're saying that, right? Because your dad probably, he felt like this would appeal to you as well. Is that right?
He's a very curious person. And then he had a very good network of friends who kind of showed him what different aspects were. I think it ideally should have been me, completed my medicine, and I should have gone with my choice. But then it was probably him exploring more than me, which kind of helped me go help me in the clear direction that I'm in. So it kind of tied in well. And the curiosity, again, just to be curious and know different things that are happening around, it just helps.
Well, I mean, and that's what I mean, because it's funny because, first, it sounds like where you've ended up is the more banker mentality of health in a way. Like, as in, it is more like, technical and data driven and stuff like that, rather than, you know, the GP side of things. And it sounds like that, and it's nothing that's ultra useful. So it's just interesting that your dad was like, I know Harsha, I think he's going to like this more from me doing, again, what a dad, huh? Just asking all their friends. And
They all wanted me to take up clinical medicine. Mm-hmm. And this was just to fill in that gap, which, I mean, in India, when we study medicine, we are technically not earning like people here. When they train in medicine, in internship, they're actually earning. In India, you don't earn until you finish your specialty training.
Oh, really?
Our parents have to fund the full,
that's crazy,
for the entire time. Up until we are 26, 27, we are still sort of taking.
You don't get any.
No, we don't. Not every institution. If you're lucky enough to be in a good institution which pays you well, you're good. But the amount of doctors that come out, you need to sort of choose your make your choices, and on most occasions, you are sort of living from your with your parents.
Yeah.
So he felt that why waste that time when you're preparing for your entrance? Just have this diploma completed, it might come of use. He didn't know the potential.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
And it was very early in India at that point in time, in 2006. When I got the job, I remember my boss telling me the work that we were doing, we were the only 14 people in India who were doing that work. And
that's
that
cool.
was fascinating. I was like, I felt I was being part of something unique. So, and that passion still stays on with me even now.
Yeah. So is that like, that's an interesting point as well, because obviously, when you talk about Asia in general and its growth over the last 20, 30 years, and its slow shift now, as you're seeing, away from obviously manufacturing and stuff to more diverse and higher technical skill things. I guess pharma is not something I'd ever really thought about with that stuff, but obviously that would be hugely there. So how's India now in terms of the global stage for pharmaceutical-based things and all that?
I think if you look at manufacturing, I think India, I don't know the figures at the top of my head because they are contributors to one of the big contributors to COVID vaccines. Mm-hmm. They're major contributors and to the COVAX facility, which sort of ensures that there's equitable distribution of vaccines. So they're big contributors to that. And outside that, I think the way I feel is in early 2000s is when the technical side of things, the pharma specializations started becoming slightly popular, because these were outsourced from developed countries to India in terms of having their offices set up across the time zones. First, take advantage of the time zones and also utilize the medical specialty skills that are available in India.
Right,
and
basically,
that's probably the wave that I caught on,
right,
which helped me come across people and mentors who were mainly from global companies, giving me that global exposures. So it made my transition easy to even travel.
Yes, because it was like a wide open.
Yeah,
it's classic blue water, sort of blue ocean, whatever it's called.
Exactly. So it's just that initial exposure which helped me. So yeah,
because when you say that's the other point though, because when you do talk about that time difference, essentially what you can do as a company, if you're able to actually do it, is be working 24 hours a day.
That's exactly the model.
Just switch over.
That's exactly the model.
Nonstop.
The teams
take a break.
Our team used to sleep in the US, and the India would start when they sleep. So it's basically taking advantage of the time zones and being more efficient with the data and how we spend our time on data. Yeah.
That's amazing, actually. That's crazy. Mm. That's cool. So your sister's a doctor as well?
My sister's a doctor as well. So she's a dermatologist practicing in India, so is her husband. So,
okay. So is it like, this could be, I'm curious, was that like, was the idea that, is doctor highly rated as the job? Is that like kind of the one you want to go for?
It is definitely one of the prestigious noble profession. That's how
it is here. It's everywhere. Yeah,
it's everywhere, and the noble profession adds meaning in a developed country. Growing up, I could see how much of an impact a doctor makes. As in, they are treated like gods, and they do a lot of social service, and they treat people for free. They hold a very different place in the society, and that's the impression that I have growing up.
So you do feel like. The even though doctors are respected here, obviously they're respected everywhere, but in terms of the difference in India, it's just another level of like.
So it's also the populations and the people having to offer different specialties. So it's a unique experience there being a doctor, especially in a rural community where I was training in clinical pharmacology. I could see that we used to go in the evenings just. Open up a table and there are people walking in with problems and you just treat them for free because they don't have money to go to the hospital. So that's the extent that people can go in terms of providing service as doctors. But of course, that's not very sustainable for if you want to earn your living. But then it has to be a right balance. Doctors tend to do a lot of service-oriented. I'm sure they're doing here as well, but then the need is different in different countries.
I was going to say, so that's the other thing as well. So I guess the more developed the country, I guess, even though this isn't maybe always true, but you generally say they're vaccinated, they're living healthier, safer lives, they're probably less rural. So generally the sickness and disease isn't as high in a more developed country.
And it's also the population.
How do you mean the population? Just the size?
I think it's the size of the people or the amount of population that come to access medical care versus country like Australia, where there is a population is not great in terms of mismatch in terms of healthcare accessibility. So it's I think the gap is quite huge that I could see when I was practicing. You would see loads of patients in a day. It's
in India.
Yeah. You're just nonstop, and that's why.
So there is still there's a feeling of scarcity of doctors a little bit.
There is a mismatch to the doctor-patient ratio, which I think there's a lot of effort in sort of bringing that up, especially in the rural setting.
Well, maybe if they paid them while they're getting practice, the parents don't have to support them.
I think they are doing completely different things. I think there are systems put in place where doctors are being paid really well, even if they choose to stay in a rural setting. There are a lot of things that have happened. But it also depends with me. I think it also depends on what drives you, and then what is fulfilling from your end and what makes you happy in terms of contributing to medicines.
Yeah.
So that's 100%. Where I landed.
I totally get that. Yeah. Which is so important.
Yeah.
But I guess that's super interesting. It's so interesting. But to go back to that perspective, because you've said this a few times now about like the best impact, which is definitely true what you're saying in terms of the greatest number is to be involved in these vaccines or any sort of technology. Yeah, new, what's the word? Not antidote, new, anything.
Breakthroughs, basically.
Breakthroughs, yeah. Being involved in that is obviously cutting edge, so it's exciting in that sense, and it's also impacting a huge number of people. But also, I guess, I feel like did that side appeal to you more as well? Okay, let me put it this way. When you were growing up, were you like, did you like technical stuff? Did you like playing around your computer? Did you like that sort of stuff? Or were you more hanging out with mates and stuff? I don't know. Like, I'm just trying to get a framework on you and which one slotted into your... Because it seems like you're well-suited and you really like what you're doing. That's why I feel like there's more behind it rather than just the calculation of which one's the greatest benefit. There's also, I actually enjoy this more. You'd get what I'm saying?
It's more an acquired taste, I would think. I wasn't a very tech-savvy person growing up. I was curious, and I did adopt the new things that come my way very quickly. And I remember being acknowledged for being a quick learner. So that's who I was. And I didn't even choose any other profession because although a lot of my friends at that point in time, because of the IT boom in India, a lot of my friends took engineering and computer science and other things. So I was driven more to medicine. So that's sort of who I was. But to your question, what appealed to me, it's probably the people interaction, working in a business setup, working in a corporate sort of an environment is probably what appealed to me. It's also probably because... how my dad used to work. I used to often go to his office and sit and see how he interacts with people. Maybe that's I'm exploring this now.
Yeah,
but
no,
then
just, well, no, I'm just guessing. nothing's one thing.
Probably true because it was a good impression that how he handles stakeholders, how he handles people, the people interaction, the customer interface. At the same time, you're doing what medicine does. So,
exactly. You're in that feeling of being part of something big.
Big.
But you're also doing it from the medicine point of view.
Exactly. The sense of purpose is always there when you're in medicine. So that's sort of what my sense of purpose is. But at the same time, it also maybe I was driven more to being in that setup or I craved for that environment maybe.
Yeah. You grew up seeing that as well as being like the cool thing.
Yeah.
I 100% understand that. Yeah.
Probably.
That just one factor. I know there's a million. I'm just saying it's fun to hear these other things.
Yes, absolutely.
I do think it's more than one thing.
It's probably the first time I'm reflecting as well. So it's very interesting.
To go back to now, like, I guess we should do a bit more of the book before we finish off. With mindset, you said that it's got tools and stuff in it that you've gone back to and actually used. Like you said, there's actionable stuff in there. Is that right?
It is. It's very solution oriented and it's very meaning driven. So it always comes back to why you're doing this and what approach you choose. The little things that makes a huge difference, especially in the environment that I work in, which is highly complex, very serendipitous environment where you need to be a good listener, have that growth mindset to pick up things and even learn and make it fulfilling for yourself and being part of something bigger. So I've always gone back to few chapters. And now I'm going back to chapters where how do you talk growth mindset to kids? And that's something very relevant to inculcate from a very young age. So it's something which I go back to.
With two doctors' parents who are happy to move around to another country just to check it out, I feel your kid's probably going to have a pretty good...
Hopefully.
I guess like So first, it sounds like you've always been at least like that a bit, like that kind of attitude yourself. When did you first read the book? Do you remember?
I think it was maybe a few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
And not too long ago. No. It was just in the last 5 years that I've been reading a lot of nonfiction, which are mainly actionable. I take recommendations because I do read a lot for a living in my day-to-day job.
Yes, it's tiring. Yeah.
So I try and pick up the recommendations and make sure that these are actionable insights that I can implement.
Yeah. It's just funny. So in your case, that's why I like to ask this, because I feel some books come along and it's actually like a flash of lightning of something you haven't even considered. But for you, this is more like, this is what I'm doing. This is just giving me more of a framework of who I am already, in a sense.
True. I think the first book I remember in school being, when I joined school, we were given a book to read. And that was called The Man, the Maker of His Own Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very small book for kids of that age. And it's like a prequel to this book that I've read. So
It
kind of brings back those memories of focusing on character, mindset, and all those aspects. Very solution-oriented. Yeah.
Right. And is this from the, that's the boarding school, the Swami Vivekananda?
Yes.
Vivekananda.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, so you had stuff back then as well, which is kind of just giving you the same guidance towards attitude and mindset.
This is more scientific, and that was more illustrative at that age.
A younger age,
This is more scientific, very robust, evidence-based, which sort of what I generally like.
Yeah. I can tell. because I don't know, I've always got this thing about... I feel like everyone loves the idea of neuroplasticity and the brain reinventing itself, but I'm like almost a cynic in a way. I'm always like, I don't know if it's that flexible, or there's people born who are proactive, there's people born who aren't, and like there's a gap, and like you got to try and make it up as best you can. So I love hearing this, that there is flexibility and possibility.
Absolutely, I think so too. And today is a good example because I like to give presentations, and that's what we do at day jobs that we have. But I've never believed to be or I've never explored the side of being an orator or a participating in an elocution or a debate of any kind. It's always that when I meet one-on-one with people, they say, hey, you should take part in a few things. But I've never sort of took that step. And this is like me sort of trying out from the book. You know, to speak.
Well, you're doing well. I think we've done all right.
So yeah, so that's sort of where my story is. So that's sort of what drove me to this book, which is good.
Yeah. I guess I think probably if I was going to say one of my hang-ups, possibly a little bit, is with something like this, with like I guess firstly using the growth mindset. I don't like the word growth in there because it sounds too entrepreneur, you know, like
that
corporate,
that is true,
it's all about growth. But it really means like a flexible mindset, an open-minded mindset.
I think it is overused, especially in an entrepreneurial corporate world, the growth mindset. But what this book tells me is that it's there's a lot of science behind it. Although people use it all the time, we need to know the science behind it to sort of understand what these mindsets are. And to me, it's more a learner's mindset. I wouldn't call it growth mindset personally.
Right.
I would call it being a learner's mindset, having that learning mindset and developing mindset, and not and which prevents you from judging any experiences or being an open, being open to different experiences, basically. Okay. Yeah,
I got all the time in the world. It's funny how that's the same word, but for me, I'm like, yeah, learner, 100%. I very much agree.
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
that could be an issue again because the growth thing.
It's more meaning driven. I think that two books to me are interconnected. One is this book, and the second book is which is very close to my heart is The Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yep, yep.
These two kind of are very complementary to me, and one book talks to another. That's how I feel it.
Is one more like the mindset's almost like a deeper dive, scientific backing of the story?
Mindset is a simplified form of it, and then what Viktor Frankl talks, which is a meaning-based decision making or a meaning based living with purpose, having a deeper meaning, it kind of is what the mindset does in a very simplified form.
Right.
To me,
it's giving you more the tools. Mindset's got more the actual
more
tools,
the actual
in it,
tools, yeah. But then the depth is from the other book. So I kind of, now that I'm talking about it, I can see that I can relate to these two books that I've read. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's kind of, because it always comes back to that finding the meaning. And then everything else kind of...
Yeah.
You can put up with anything if you've got the right meaning.
Correct. And correct. Yeah, and that you need to know the whys and have a deepest purpose of meaning.
Being able to have that vision.
And vision. And then you take your small steps and eventually things will fall in place as long as you're putting effort and you know the meaning and purpose.
And yeah, I mean, I actually... It's something which I've kind of struggled with sometimes. But yeah, it's that idea that if you're working for something... And even if you never get there, and even if you like, that's a funny thing. Someone who's got a goal they're working for and they never get there, but they live their whole life struggling as well, that can actually be a more fulfilling life than someone who's kicking back and just having a great time and getting drunk with his mates every day. It's weird that, but it's like, yeah.
So that's how the human brain works. That's very nice that you say that because the one of the goals or inherent drives and passion for physicians working in this industry is being part of breakthroughs.
Yeah,
being part of something breakthrough in their lifetime of their pharmaceutical career, which might not happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you might work on all the failed drugs, or you might be part of something very cross-sectionary that you would have touched, which you wouldn't have seen it make it to the market or patients. Being part of a breakthrough is what you crave for, but the good part is that as long as we appreciate the effort, even if you're not part of it and you retire, you would have done something very meaningful. So I think that's what that perspective is sort of what you were trying to say,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah, that's 100% true because being part of a big breakthrough would be rare, like a lot of it. So like, yeah, a lot of people would have this issue where they're like, oh, all we've ever gotten is a null hypothesis, but it's like you need those nulls to get to something else.
True. And if you look at the history, if you take US as an example, FDA, I think they have, in history, they've probably approved 1,500 drugs. That's about it. And probably some of which are in the same class of drugs and not real breakthroughs. So being part of breakthrough is what everybody craves for.
Hmm.
But then you don't necessarily sort of touch every aspect. You kind of, you'll be fulfilled if you recognize that your effort is more meaningful than your actual endpoint, as long as you're working on making an impact to patients, you know? So, yeah.
That's such a interesting, relevant thing to your field as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, nice. That's why this book is so close to me in terms of perspectives.
You're doing my job for me, but I feel even more like it's rigged and you've chosen this book well. Okay, well, look, you've obviously thought about it so much already, but we do have to probably stop it there. But I always do like to ask, do you feel like you've got any new connections between yourself and the book in thinking about it for this podcast or talking about it on this podcast or anything like that?
No, there were a lot of reflections that I wasn't aware. For example, what drove me to the industry, and I've told this story so many times to people because they ask me, what are you doing here in the pharma industry?
Very direct, those people.
But there are certain aspects in this conversation which definitely have triggered some memories from the past and few things which I think I can connect those dots now. Hmm. Definitely. It's great to have these conversations and such interesting perspectives from your end as well. I think
you're the one providing the real juice here.
it was really great.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. Usually when I've got performers on, I'm like, where can we catch you? On Instagram, whatever. But with your case, just I think we'll just wait for the vaccine.
Maybe, yes. It'll be one of those cases where if we come out of this pandemic, just being associated with this industry is very fulfilling.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on.
Yeah. Thank you very much, George. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.